I went to school. I went to college for aircraft maintenance because I thought I liked airplanes. And that was a two-year program. And at coming up on, well, about this time of year, it was, program was finishing, end of April, and I was thinking, well, I should probably do something with all the information that I've learned. So I started applying to places, and I sent out quite a few, like all my classmates were doing the same. They're sending out letters and resumes and trying to get interviews, and I sent out quite a number. And you know how many I got back? Not even one. Not one. Now, at the time, I had been very interested in missions and thought I might use what I had learned in a mission field. And someone had said, well, there's this guy who's home on furlough from Africa. Why don't you just write him a letter? This is back when there was, actually, was it an email? It's one of the two. There's no texting. Things have moved very quickly, haven't they? It was an email or a text. No, it wasn't. It was an email or an actual snail mail that I wrote. And the idea was just to get a direction for how to start and maybe get into that. And I thought that was, that's sort of putting the cart before the horse. I'd like to get some experience in my chosen field and then work up to that kind of thing. Anyway, this guy responds to me almost immediately. And he says, tell me what you think you want to do. It just so happened, right? It just so happened that he writes me back immediately, and we start this dialogue. And so this was April, and by October, I was on a plane headed to Zambia, where I spent the next 2 years working on an airplane. We're going to get back to that. Chapter 2 of Esther, we find that the king, Ahasuerus, it doesn't say that, but we know from history that between the end of chapter 1 and the beginning of chapter 2, Ahasuerus went on a campaign against the Greeks, and he lost quite badly. So he came back to lick his wounds. I think Herodotus says something like he comforted himself with his harem, as you do, right? When things don't go your way, you go home and you comfort yourself with your harem. And this sort of follows what happens here in chapter 2, because he remembers. It says, when the anger of Ahasuerus had abated and he lost a war, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. And as you remember, what had been decreed against her was that she was no longer to come into the presence of the king. She was no longer to be first wife, as it were. Even though it seems that she might have been the heir, the mother of the heir of the throne already, in which case he kind of needed to keep her around. History shows that she was sort of still around at some point in Ahasuerus' son's reign. So he didn't put her to death, but he remembered what he had done, and that was to kick her out, basically. And then the king's young men, who were, really smart guys, they said, let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king. I think he was hanging around with the wrong people, quite frankly. And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdoms to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the citadel, under the custody of Haggai, whatever, king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given to them, and let the young woman who pleases the king be queen. instead of Vashti. So, a beauty contest. This pleased the king, and he did so. Now, we're introduced to some new characters. So, Ahasuerus is in chapter 2, only as sort of a function to lead up to some newer characters in the story. Now, there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Yair, the son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite. Now, this is important, and I don't want to give away too much for the person that has to cover this in the next chapter, but it's important to the story, especially if you're a Jewish person reading this, to know that Mordecai, the Jew, was a Benjaminite, the son of Kish. And the reason that is important, because the main antagonist in this story is a man called Haman, who is an Agagite. Now, if you know your Jewish history, and of course if you're a Jew, you would, reading this, you would know that there was another Benjaminite, a son of Kish, another Kish, not the same, who was ordered by God to destroy a king and everything that he had. And he didn't. That king's name was Agag. Whoever is writing this has some literary prowess, I'll tell you that. He's connecting dots. He wants people to know that what he's about to tell, he's foreshadowing that this is a centuries-old conflict. So Saul, the first king of the Jews, was a Benjaminite. He was the son of a man named Kish. And God, you remember the story? God, through Samuel, told Saul that he had to destroy this king Agag, who's an Amorite, I think, and everything that he had to destroy everything, right? And Saul did not, remember? And his excuse was, well, I wanted to leave some stuff so we could sacrifice to the Lord. So he didn't do what he was supposed to do. And now, years later, many years later, we have this conflict coming up again where a Benjaminite, the son of Kish, is going up against an Agagite. Ah, yeah, some literary tension there. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about that. Whoever gets chapter 3, he's got to deal with that. So, he was the son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. Just in case you're a little confused, if you're doing some math there, if Mordecai was the son of somebody who's actually the son of somebody who had been in that wave that had been carried away from Judea, that would make him improbably old, because it's now been over 100 years since that happened. So more unlikely what is being referred to when it says he's the son of. It's not uncommon in the Bible for people to refer to themselves as the son of their grandparents or their grandfather. That's not uncommon. So that's probably what it's meaning. In a lot of ways, Bible writers are very precise in that they don't tell you things that they don't want you, that they don't think you should know. they just leave it out entirely. So as modern readers, we like to know all the details, whether or not they're relevant. Bible writers don't go in for that kind of thing. They've got, you know, so much ink, they've got so much space on the page, they're only going to tell you what they want to tell you for the purposes of the story. So when they say he's the son of, it probably just means that he's the son of, or he's actually the grandson of someone who was carried away. But the tie is back to the exile. It's a reference to the exile is what it is. And he was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. So that makes Mordecai Esther's cousin. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in the custody of Hegai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in the custody of Hegai, who had charge of the women. And the young woman just so happened, this is me interjecting some words here, it just so happened to win his favor. And he quickly provided her with cosmetics and her portion of food with 7 chosen young women from the king's palace, and he advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. So in that case, there's a harem is sort of like a chicken coop. Right? Because if you've kept chickens, you know that there's a pecking order. Harems also have pecking orders. So he knew this, and he advanced her to the best place. Just so happened that this happened. And every day, I'm skipped a part. Esther had not made known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. So this is the first part of the chapter. And what it is sort of introduction to the next part. And if you'll notice, as you read the second part, as we go through the second part of the chapter, it's describing what actually happened in reference to the first part. So in the first part, you have the king's young men saying, this is what you should do and this is what should happen. And in the second part, you sort of have the fulfillment of that. Notice. Now, when the turn came for each young woman to go into King Ahasuerus after being 12 months under the regulations for the women's, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months. 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for women. When the young woman went into the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. Can you imagine this? This is like, you've been to the spa, right? Everybody's been to a spa, of course. Can you imagine doing this for 12 months, this sort of thing? I was doing some reading, and there was an interesting article where archaeologists from 20th century, W.F. Albright, they had discovered these things. They looked like oil burners, and the original assumption was that they were used in worship because you would burn incense, of course, to the gods for worship. His contention was that, no, they were probably actually used, whatever they'd found. They did burn scented oils and incense, but what they were was actually for this kind of thing, where they would burn the oil or the incense in this pot kind of thing, and a woman would take, you know, her snuggie, and she would sort of tent herself over it, and it would just infuse her clothes, infuse her skin with these really nice scents. And of course, the scents that are described are the same scents that perfumers are using in whatever you think you're wearing right now. You're not wearing anything? Oh, I thought I... No, that's Holstein. <laughs> 12 months. She smelled good. They all smelled good. Now when the turn came for Esther, the son of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Hegai, the king's eunuch who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, this is very precise, which is the 10th month of Tebet, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she just so happened to win grace and favor in his sight. More than all the other virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants, and it was Esther's feast. And he also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. Perhaps someone should suggest something similar to Justin Trudeau if he's looking for a new wife, right? I could do with some tax relief. And now when the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not made known her kindred or her people, as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther obeyed Mordecai, just as when she was brought up by him. And in those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, two eunuchs, Bigtan and Teresh, who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told the king, in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows. And it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. This story is challenging to talk about Esther in this way, the way we're doing it. And I'll tell you why. Every year, the observant Jews celebrate a feast, a time, and it's called Purim. And the whole reason for celebrating this particular festival is because of what happened in this book. In fact, you'll understand as we read through the story, if you're not already familiar with it, just where that term came from, Purim. I'm not going to talk about it today. But every year, when they celebrate this, they read through the entire story, front to back. Because the sense and the meaning of Esther is in its whole. It's in the whole story. It's not in the little bits. So it's challenging when you're sort of doing it chapter by chapter to just extract something out of that and say, well, okay, this is what this means, because they all have to do with each other. So what the author is trying to do, because it's a whole unit, the author is setting up and telling us things that only make sense for the entire story. So the reason that we know about the king Ahasuerus, the reason that we know about Mordecai and Esther and what happened with them, and even just these funny little details about where Mordecai was at the king's gate, and he just so happened, right, to hear a plot to overthrow the king, and they just so happened to be in Susa at the time the king was having a meltdown over his wife. All these things lead into the rest of the story when the conflict really starts up, right? Because in the next chapter, we're introduced to the main antagonist, to Haman, who gets a hate on for the Jews and wants to not just destroy one guy, but his whole nation. And perhaps the reason why this is so important for Jewish people is that perhaps at no other point in their history were Jews as a people, as a culture, as a people, more in danger of being entirely annihilated than at any other time. Now, they've been in trouble, okay? A lot throughout their history. There's no doubt about it. But perhaps at no other point were they more in danger than at this time. Because the edict that was passed was for the entire, all of the people, all the Jewish people in the entire empire. So that included not just those that were close to the king in Persia, but it included those that had already gone back. So this is following the decree of Ahasuerus' father, Cyrus, that he said the Jews can go back to their land, they can rebuild their temple, they can rebuild their walls. That was still part of the Persian Empire. So the edict that Haman got signed off on, really, he did, it got through, was for everybody, all the Jews in the entire empire, all of them. There was nowhere they could go. You understand? There was nowhere they could go. There was nowhere they could escape because the entire world was Persian. So when you feel that kind of, we don't know. We don't know what that is like. To have your entire way of life, your entire culture, your entire identity, or whatever you think of that, whatever that is, completely wiped out within a few days, or the danger of that, being under that kind of weight. But that's what's going on in this story. And the reason that we are reading this story and have it in our hands is because something just happened to happen. Notice the story of Esther, and as this has been mentioned before, does not mention God. There's no mention of God. There's no mention of worship. No mention of deity. It is sort of implied, but no specific mention of it at all. Further to that, the author of Esther makes no judgments on any of the characters. Have you noticed that? When you're reading through Esther, the author and neither the characters in themselves have any kind of introspection. You don't know what they're thinking. We have no idea how Esther herself thought about her situation. We have no idea how Mordecai himself thought of his situation. The only thing that is described is their actions. We know what Esther looked like, that she was very beautiful, but that's only so that we know the reason that she got in to this whole beauty thing in the first place. We have no idea what she thought about it. There's a lot of passive language used in that she was taken and things were done to them. And now that may suggest that they were unwilling, but it doesn't say that either. I think the only thing that the author of Esther is trying to let us know and trying to let his readers know, because I think he had a particular audience when he was writing this, was that they lived in a time and in a place where, for them, as Jews, what they did and what they said and who they were really was of no consequence. They really had no choices. It was live or die, really. Could Esther have refused? I'm sure she could have, but then we wouldn't have a story. But the author doesn't make any judgments on that, right? He doesn't really make any judgments. And so, the temptation, of course, is for interpreters, is to read the story and say, okay, well, this is what this is saying about how we should behave or how we should live our lives. And I think if you do that, I mean, you can do that. You can do that, and people have done it. This is my contention. My contention is that if you sort of fall into that and assuming that the Bible is always trying to tell us how to behave and using the book of Esther in this way and making judgments on Esther's character and what she did or didn't do and what Mordecai did or didn't do and even on what the king or Vashti did or didn't do is to miss the point of this whole book. Because the point of this book is its entire story, its entire thing. And it what happens at the end. And what happens at the end is led up to and explained by what happens at the beginning and everything that goes to the middle. And what we've just read today in chapter 2 prepares us in quite a unique way for what happens. It just so happened. It just so happened. We all live lives. And that's not saying a whole lot, is it? Come on, Joel, come up with something better than that. We all live lives. We all live lives as followers of God. And the challenge for anybody who's ever followed Yahweh or Elohim or Christ, God, is how is God working in my life? How is God speaking in my life? How does that work? And we like what we really like when we read the Bible and we think of, you know, the challenges in our lives, and you know, because we're all in struggles, like there's things that we deal with and they're all quite unique sometimes, is what does God want me to do? How close is God? Remember that for these people, Mordecai and Esther were born in Persia. They didn't come from Israel. They didn't come from Judea. They had no idea what it was like to worship at a temple. You ever think about that? They had no idea what it was like to be ruled by a king who himself was supposed to be influenced by God and to rule according to Torah. They didn't know. They didn't know what that was like. They were ensconced in this culture that was very, really anti-Yahweh. They had their gods. They had lots of them. And even Esther's name sounds like, it sounds like a name, I'm trying to remember the, it's Ishtar, which is a Babylonian goddess, the goddess of love and of war. So even though she grew up as her Jewish name, Hadassah, which I think means myrtle. Everybody have an Aunt Myrtle? Somewhere in the family tree, we all do, right? Hadassah, it's a beautiful name. But we know her by her foreign name, her Persian name, which sounds like this goddess of love and war. Basically the Aphrodite or Venus of ancient Babylon and Persia. This is their culture. This is what they're in. We don't know how much of it Esther and Mordecai had imbibed into their own life. We don't know. Are we to make judgments on that? You can. But then, you're kind of pointing the finger, right? And the problem about the finger being pointed is that there's, you know, there's a few pointed back. Because we all live in a culture. We live in an anti-God culture. And it's becoming increasingly more anti-God. I don't follow the news much, because it doesn't seem that I have to. Because someone's always telling me of all the terrible stuff that's happening. And that's not the half of it. What they tell you on the news, the talking heads, that's pretty carefully scripted. The real news is much worse. Amy's been doing some studying on Nero. There's a fella. Nero, who was the emperor around the time that Paul may or may not have died, 69, 68. And the excesses that that historians describe about him just blow your mind, right? Like, how could anybody do that? And yet, when you look carefully at who's doing what in our world today, it's not that much different. This is the world of Esther. This is the world of Mordecai. This is our world. Where is God in that? Where is God in that? Because Mordecai doesn't talk about God. Esther doesn't talk about God. We have no idea whether they thought that much about Yahweh at all. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. And for that, my contention is that's sort of the point. Because when you read this story in its entirety, you are meant to see God even when he is not mentioned. How? How are you supposed to do that? When I was looking for a job, there was no bolt of lightning. Nothing happened to me on the road to Damascus. I've never been close to Damascus. There was no visions, there was no dreams. Things just unfolded. I sent out resumes like everybody else. I sent out letters and I got nothing. It just so happened that I got nothing back. And then someone just happened to mention that I should write a particular person who I had no expectation that they would ever write me back, because it was, you know, totally out of the blue, totally cold call. And they responded. They just so happened to respond immediately. And then it just so happened that things worked out in my life. If you would have told me, you know what, by the end of the year, you're going to be in another continent, I wouldn't have believed you. Even when I was flying over the continent. I remember, London down to Zambia. You're flying pretty much the entire length of the continent of Africa. And so you look out the window and you see it, right? I couldn't believe I was flying over Africa, right? I couldn't believe it. I think, what am I doing here? There's the savannah. The only time I'd ever seen savannah was on David Attenborough specials. And here I was, flying over it, and I'm going to be here for the next 2-3 years. I had no idea. It just so happened. And in this story, it just so happens that Esther, this Jewish girl, just so happens to be so beautiful and so good-looking that she is taken up at this particular time, and she's taken into the harem. Well, that doesn't sound all that exciting. I mean, we don't know. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. We have no idea of her living situation. She may have been dirt poor. Maybe the harem was actually a step up. I mean, the spa treatments sounded pretty nice. Hot rock massage? Come on. We don't know. And then it just so happened that once she was in there, you know, she's with who, we don't know how many other girls, hundreds, and it just so happens that she found favor with the chief eunuch of that whole place, who's mentioned 3 times in this chapter. He must have been a pretty important guy, and she found favor with him, and he advanced her to the best place in the harem. Not only that, but when she had her night with the king, do I need to explain what happened? They didn't have a chat, okay? There may have been some chatting, but there are other things. She became queen. And it just so happened that after that one night, she managed to please the king so much, and you can only imagine what that would have involved, that he loved her. Now, I always wondered what that meant, you know, for this guy. Because the picture that we have up until this point of King Ahasuerus is that his capacity for love, as we can, you know, understand love and God's love, that may have not been what they're talking about. But whatever, she just so happened to impress him enough to the point where he felt that he needed to put the crown on her head. It just so happened. And even though God is not mentioned, you're meant to see God. This is our life, okay? This is your life. This is my life. Things happen. And God is so powerful that it doesn't matter what you choose to do. You are a free will being. You are made in the image of God. And being made in the image of God, because God himself is a free will being, means that you also are a free will being. So you can make whatever choices you like, and you do. And so do those around you. They make the choices that they're going to make. And sometimes those choices, especially when they're made by the rich and powerful, seem like they're going to overwhelm those of us that want to make, you know, good, moral, right choices, our understanding of them. And it seems like those choices made by rich and powerful people are going to entirely overwhelm and negate all the good choices that we can make. But the story of Esther is that that is not true. It's not true. Because despite the choices that people make, God just so happens to cause things to happen so that he takes care of his people. He takes care of his people. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for this time in your word this morning. We thank you for Esther and Mordecai. But more important, we thank you for yourself. We're thankful for your faithfulness. You've promised faithfulness to your people. You've said it over and over again in your word. And there's consequences for not following you. That is true. And as your people, we have suffered from not following your ways. But you're always faithful to what you say you're going to do. And that is true for the good things as well as the bad. And your people traditionally have always, always cried out to you to be faithful to keeping your covenant, to keep your promises, in bringing salvation. And that's exactly what you've done. You brought salvation to Esther's people in Esther's time. And you've brought salvation to her descendants through a man who hung on the cross. And through that action, you brought salvation to the entire world, so that the entire world had the opportunity to be called your people. Lord, we thank you for that. We praise you for that. And in our lives from day to day, help us to look for the things that just so happen, where we can see you working. These things we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.